I'm not going to begin with the Middle East. I'll go on to talk about that in the next item. I just thought I'd begin with what looks like, to me at least, the writing on the wall. Now, we can all be wrong when it comes to making predictions. And of course, what I'm talking about is the last two by-elections, one in Mid-Bedfordshire. I think that's old Nadine. She should have been Lady, shouldn't she? Lady Norris or Doris. Nadine Doris, that's it. And then Tamsworth, Mr. Pincher. You know the statistics, but they are worthwhile repeating. The Tories in Mid-Bedfordshire, apparently, ever since the seat was created, it's been a Tory seat. I don't know exactly where Mid-Bedfordshire is. I know where Bedfordshire is, but exactly what makes up Mid-Bedfordshire, I'm not quite sure. Either way, it's solidly Tory, or at least was solidly Tory. 24,600 majority, swing to Labour 23.9%, let's just call it 24%, with the Labour candidate ending up with a 1,192 majority. Tamworth, let me see, Labour ended up on 45.8%, Tories 40.7%, similar swing, but even greater. The Tories basically suffered a devastating defeat. And indeed, I don't know whether it's right, but we actually have stories going around about the Chancellor, Hunt, potentially quitting before the next election. To avoid what is called in the press the Michael Portillo moment. I can remember the Michael Portillo moment. Michael Portillo was a right-wing, hard-line Thatcherite, utterly intolerant. And I think, didn't he, in one of his Tory conference speeches, come out with the SAS? This is the Special Air Services, the special forces of the British Army. That's what he worshipped. And I can't remember the guy, but it was up in North London who defeated him. But it was a complete outsider, beat Michael Portillo, who had obviously had leadership ambition. So there's an awful lot of Tories either contemplating quitting before the next general election. Or preparing for the Michael Portillo moment when they actually get beaten, one would guess, by a Labour candidate. I think that, the pundits are right. It's not so much that Labour is popular, it's that the Tories are unpopular. And if you want to get rid of the Tories, now we have a situation in terms of opinion polls. And in terms of moderate, sensible opinion, where Sir Keir and his team look like they will be forming the next government. Just thought I would bung in what some comrades on the left were saying a very short time ago. And I'm saying this not to be cruel, but because I think that they were badly mistaken. When it came to assessing Keir Starmer and what he's all about, we were told, for example, that Sir Keir didn't really want to beat the Tories. This is when the Labour Party, was trailing the Tories in opinion polls, not doing brilliantly at all in by-elections in their own, traditional territory. Yes, we were told that what Sir Keir really wanted to do was just bash the left. They didn't understand that the Labour Party could function perfectly well without the dues being paid by the left, without the left acting as the donkeys going around on the knocker, going around dishing out leaflets door to door and all the rest of it. Now, what Keir potentially will have, we don't know, but potentially at least, according to our illustrious correspondent in the Weekly Worker, potentially he'll have the Sun on side, the Sun, Sunday Times, the Times on side. And indeed, as we've reported in the pages of the Weekly Worker, you know, it's all publicly available. This year so far, we've had a situation where seriously rich individuals and companies have paid into the coffers of the Labour Party considerably more than trade unions have. And they're the traditional financiers of the Labour Party. So it's true that the mass membership of the Labour Party has shrunk. I think they've lost something like 200,000 members, could be more. Tis worthwhile pointing out, though, that they have had people joining. I think you and me can guess what sort of people are joining or maybe rejoining. They certainly look at the Labour Party. It's on the up, and they've got a chance of either getting into Parliament or more likely into the council chamber. And if it isn't that, then there's all sorts of goodies, all sorts of quangos to fill, government advisors, you name it. You know, the payroll, not just for the Labour Party itself, but a party in government. In other words, their ability to dish out the goodies, the sweeties. Is going to be considerable. So yes, undoubtedly the Labour Party has shrunk, but the money has more than been replaced, and indeed there's an eager cadre basis now of careerists who want to get in on the act. And again, I haven't been to Labour Party conference for some time, but we've had comrades up there in Liverpool just a few weeks ago, and the most noticeable thing is now the presence of big business, you know, in special reception stands, and they're all over subscribed. So the Labour Party is, how should, but what's it, the party of all businesses, and what that is meant to convey is they're not just the party of the hedge funds and hedge funds. Managers, they're there for all business, and they hope to reconcile that with trade unions. Well, hey. Okay, so that's my first comment. In terms of the Middle East itself, I'm not going to add really anything compared with what I said last week. I think the chances are. Now we've seen the great and the good pass through Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, and other such places. The ground operation will start. And until that starts, I don't know myself really what to expect. I mean, is the United States, and it doesn't seem like it to me at least, going to give Netanyahu the go-ahead to ethnically cleanse half or maybe all of the Gaza Strip? I mean, I asked the question. I haven't got a clue. From what he says, it's a no. Note his comments about the United States getting it wrong when it came to 9/11 by overreacting, that's his words, not mine, and invading Afghanistan and invading Iraq. So they're certainly not pushing Israel to do that. On the other hand, are they going to stop it? You know, when you get a situation of where Israel is denying electricity, denying you know, medical equipment, medicine, denying water, it's clear what Netanyahu has in mind. And that's not just clearing people out of Gaza City and the north itself, but forcing people basically to the gate, on the Egyptian border. And who knows what that then would result, what the result would that be in Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Iran, Saudi Arabia. I doubt very much myself that MBS is actually a popular figure in Saudi Arabia. Will there be a palace coup, in Riyadh? I don't know. All of these things are possible. We simply don't know. So what I thought I would do, before we actually see things develop, with the continued air attacks and then one would guess ground operations, is simply to comment not on the demonstrations that have been happening in the Muslim and Arab world, but just to convey for comrades who weren't there in London yesterday, at least my impressions. We did have other comrades there. Maybe they want to add their impressions to mine. There's no doubt that this demonstration yesterday was massively bigger than the large demonstration the week before. And it wasn't just a question of size, it was a question of who it drew upon. What was really noticeable to me compared with a week ago is that there were quite a lot of people like me on the demonstration. I'm talking about, people who'd been on this demonstration, been on that demonstration. And that didn't just apply to left wingers. It also applied to people who were there who are Palestinians, people who are there, in terms of religious solidarity with the Muslims in Palestine. You were dealing with an older generation. You were dealing with people who'd, been there, done it, sort of type idea. Yesterday, you had a massive number of young people. And again, just giving it in a very impressionistic way, it struck me as mixed groups. Young white women, young white men, but with their friends that were either part Palestinian, all Palestinian, Muslim, I don't know what, but that was the characteristic of yesterday. And the spirit was incredible. It was hugely militant. Of course, it was massively mixed when it comes to the politics. So, for example, not only did we see, as you would expect, all the left out with stalls and papers, but you also saw. I did on a whole number of different occasions, devout Muslims doing their prayers at the appropriate time. And I have no doubt that the Tory press is reporting instances of people shouting out jihad. What exactly they meant by jihad, I don't know. But I would guess that's some sort of approval of Hamas, some sort of approval of Islamic jihad. I don't think myself that would be the sort of words that Fatah, secular, the secular left would use. I know Zinoviev famously used it, but my expectation is that these people are in solidarity with Hamas. Yes, if you went out with a banner. That said solidarity with Hamas. I'm sure that the police would have arrested those people. I don't know how many arrests there were yesterday, other than very few. It was, as I say, a militant, but I would say a good-spirited demonstration. I mean, I even saw some twats, for example, dressed up as crusaders. I mean, what the hell? Political message that was meant to send, but people treated them as they ought to be treated, and that is as a joke. I mean, you could describe it a push Israel as a crusader state. Except, of course, famously, wasn't it the Third Crusade? I think when they took Jerusalem, someone will tell me if I'm right or wrong, they actually massacred the Jews, as well as the Fourth Crusade, again from my memory of my history books, wrecking Constantinople, for example, Orthodox, the center of Orthodox Christianity. Okay, so I also thought that it would just be worthwhile mentioning this campaign by the right and by the forces of Zionism to bend the BBC to their will. Now, you could take what I've just said and say, you prat, Jack Conrad. I mean, all you need to do is switch on the news on any radio station, on any TV station run by the BBC, and basically what you get is a Zionist message. It was Hamas that carried out these atrocities, and it did carry out atrocities. And therefore, because Israel has the right to defend itself, okay, within limits, they don't quite like denying people, water, electricity, and medicines. Nonetheless, if it's done humanely, this is the sort of BBC, if you bomb people humanely, then that's okay. If you humanely go in with ground forces, that's okay. That's the agenda of the BBC, or the subtext that at least I read into it. But note, and this has been my experience just listening to Radio 4 News, the number of Zionists in Britain and the number of Zionists in Israel being interviewed by the BBC, who first encounter with the BBC, are making the point, I find it disgraceful that the BBC doesn't describe Hamas as a terrorist organization. And you know the formula that the BBC comes out with. And what it's coming out with now consistently is Hamas, an organization that is widely called a terrorist organization, and including by the British government. It really reminds me of the upstanding, balanced BBC when it was reporting the so-called troubles in Northern Ireland in the Six Counties, when it was reporting Sinn Féin as a, an outfit of terrorists. The IRA were always cowardly. And you had the ridiculous situation where the BBC, of course, complied with the Tory government in preventing us hearing the voice of Gerry Adams or Martin McGuinness. And we had actors reading or voicing their words. This was to other them. And that's what's been going on. For me, when you've got a situation of where you've got aircraft dropping bombs or shooting missiles, when you've got a situation where tanks and armored cars will be going into Gaza City in terms of urban warfare, to me, that is terrorism. When you've got a situation of where you tell a million plus people to leave within hours, or we bomb you, that is terrorism. They're putting the fear of God into these people, and they want to put the fear of God into these people to such an extent that they actually get out of the Gaza Strip itself. So I have no problem myself describing Hamas as a terrorist organization. When you explode a bomb, on a bus, that is an act of terror. To me, there's no doubt about it. But what I would make the point about that is that terror is a military tactic, and all armies, all official armies, and all unofficial armies use it. But of course, what we get in the BBC, what we get in the Western media, is a distinction between the terror of the small time outfit and the terror of the United States, in Iraq or Afghanistan, or the terror that's meted out by the Israeli defense force. So I just wanted to explore that sort of idea and make the distinction, and I think it is worthwhile making, between the use of terror as a strategy or the use of terror as a tactic. And I would certainly make the argument that if we look, for example, at the Russian Revolution, while these things aren't pure, if you look at the Narodniks, if you look at the socialist revolutionaries, they were committed to terrorism as a strategy, the idea that brave individuals, and let's call them what they are, brave individuals who almost certainly will die as a result of them throwing a bomb or wearing a bomb on their body, or taking a shot at an official, either you're going to be killed on the spot, or they're going to try you, hang you, or otherwise kill you. So these people are far from cowardly. But there's a difference, isn't there, between the approach of look at this brave individual and admire them and follow that particular organization, and an organization that says if we take out enough czarist officials, this will somehow make the regime non-functional. And I think that's delusional. But we should recognize that, if we look at the Bolsheviks, for example, it's not for nothing that they had red terror. In the Civil War, they carried out absolutely awful measures against the whites. But I do think it's worthwhile just backgrounding that for a moment. Initially, when the Bolsheviks came to power, they would have some Tsarist general or some Tsarist admiral, and they would say, sign this piece of paper that you won't do any harm to the new regime, you won't take up arms. And they would duly sign the piece of paper, and then they would go away. And with the help of Britain, with the help of France, with the help of the United States, with the help of all number of external powers, yes, internal counter-revolution was generated. And you had white armies who would go into towns, go into villages, and massacre every Jew and every Bolshevik that they could get hold of. And precisely the Bolshevik response to that was Red Terror. So Red Terror wasn't something that was built in to the revolution, but the Bolsheviks had been educated, by the French Revolution, not as an exact model, but nonetheless, they knew all about Robespierre and his terror, and were prepared to meet terror with terror. You can ask, and it's perfectly legitimate, and I don't know how effective a terror is as a military tactic. Myself, I'm at least skeptical about it. The idea of Israel bombing Gaza, and that somehow alienates people from Hamas, I'm not convinced by that. From what I understand, in terms of the terror and the terrorism, and I think that's the right word for it, that was carried out by the United States Air Force, but also the British Air Force, against German cities, against German civilian populations, the natural opponents of the Nazis, people, i.e., the urban proletariat, who are never reconciled to the Nazis. As far as the British were concerned, this was a legitimate target. Did that mean that that population blamed the Nazis for the death of their loved ones? No, of course not. They blamed the British Air Force. They blamed the US Air Force. And as I understand the situation, ordinary people, called these The pilots, who are again brave individuals, are terror pilots, because night after night, and in the case of the United States, day after day, they visited terror on the population. And indeed, my understanding is that the British developed techniques of bombing that were designed to create a firestorm. And what that means is that you create a situation of where people don't necessarily die from fire, they're asphyxiated because you suck all the oxygen out, and you just have people suffocating, and in their thousands and tens of thousands. I would call that terrorism myself. Okay. We could go on and on, but suffice to say, I think all states are built on some degree of terror, force, and certainly empires are built on the basis of terror and terrorism. Okay. Just lastly, I thought I would touch upon what some fear is becoming a forgotten war. Because, of course, what has been going on as we speak and as we've demonstrated and as we've watched, the horror unfold in Gaza and potentially beyond, what we've been having is the last gasps, I think it would be safe to say, of the Ukrainian government's spring. I think it'd be fair enough to say summer offensive. I think we're now into autumn, and what autumn brings in that part of the world is the rains, and that just makes military operations not impossible, but extremely problematic. Moving people on the ground, by foot, becomes extraordinarily difficult because you sink into mud. And what goes for infantry most certainly goes for trucks, which are delivering ammunition, fuel, spare parts, food for your frontline troops, and even tanks are endangered of getting bogged down in the Ukrainian mud. So we've had news of Ukrainian advances somewhere in Donetsk, and we've seen the coverage of some raid over the Dnipro. All of that, to me, I have to say, leaves me utterly cold, because what we're dealing with is sort of World War I type advances on the Western Front at an enormous human cost. Of course, when we have the reporting by the BBC and other such outlets, it's always Russian tanks that are destroyed, Russian armored cars, Russian troops. We get hardly a tweet about the losses suffered by the Ukrainian side. But we know, anyone knows, that when you look at the Russian defenses, we must be dealing with a death rate of 3 to 1. For whatever. For every Russian that dies, in a trench, defending that trench, at least, surely, three Ukrainians will die, and their armored cars and their tanks and whatever other equipment that they've got. And for what? We're dealing with temporary advances, of course, no breakthroughs. And if you look at the map, what's interesting to me is, as well as this much heralded Ukrainian offensive, if you actually look, okay, it's a very thin line. What you've actually got in most sectors are small, but nonetheless real Russian advances. Of course, as I said, no breakthrough, no cities being taken, maybe a village lost here and retaken there, but nonetheless. It is noticeable that in terms of some commentary, It's something I've commented on. Ukraine has run out of volunteers. The enthusiasts who were there signing up to the Ukrainian army to begin with, they are in the army or they're dead. And Ukraine is now increasingly relying not just on young men as they become 18, but increasingly relying on the unwilling, ones that don't want to fight, fear fighting, or not committed for whatever reason. I don't know, I can't read minds. But that is the situation. And it is noticeable that although Russia has got a lot more in the way of human reserves, Putin has not yet made the decision to go for a wider human mobilization. Anyway, I merely comment in that respect. So just a couple of other points in respect to the sort of forgotten war. I've just been reading an article in, let me get it right, Foreign Affairs, an American journal. And it says, and to me, this is just a giveaway, comrades. It says, this is by one Oz, let me get my Kachari. I think he's a British Lebanese journalist. Either way, the headline is, and that's the drift of the article, stop focusing on the land. Because precisely people like me, people like you, all journalists can look at the satellite photographs and the maps that are coming out and going, Jesus Christ, what offensive. This much heralded offensive that was going to get to the Black Sea, which I don't think it ever was, hasn't made any noticeable progress. And yet we hear stories of 70,000. That's from the Ukrainian side, 70,000 Ukrainian deaths officially admitted in this offensive. So no wonder pro-Ukrainian, pro-Zelensky journalists, pro-imperialist, pro-NATO journalists are saying, don't concentrate on the land. You guessed it. They want to concentrate on the sea. And so what you have from their point of view is this marvel of where Ukraine, which has got no navy, absolutely no navy, they scuttled their only ship apparently to stop it falling into the hands of the Russians. So they've got no flagship, but they've got sea drones, they've got missiles, and what they've forced, and it seems to be the case, they forced Russia to withdraw a lot of their ships to the east to, I'll say, Georgian, but Georgian pro-Russian territory, but basically get these ships out of the way. And this journalist, our friend Oz, is boasting how, even without a navy, how successful Ukraine has been. This is delusional. Yes, it's certainly true that Russia has taken some hits in Sebastopol. Some ships have been damaged. And yes, it's true, they've moved them. But that doesn't mean that, therefore, the Black Sea isn't a Russian sea or isn't. It's certainly not a Ukrainian sea. So this journalist is boasting about grain shipments going out of Ukraine into the world market. But that's via river crossing. It's not via the Black Sea. And what's coming out of the Black Sea, anything that's moving that's Ukrainian out of the Black Sea or carrying Ukrainian, is done as part of an agreement. It's not defying, it's not two fingers up to the Russian navy. After all, if your surface ships are hit, they've certainly got submarines that can knock out any shipping or missiles for that matter. So I think that this is, how should you put it, covering up from what we have to call the failure of Ukraine's summer offensive. And again, another article that's just worthwhile quoting on that score, and this is in the Financial Times, and this is by one Timothy Snyder. He's a Harvard academic, and his drift, and the purpose of his article is, don't use the word stalemate. Stalemate's all very good and well in chess. If your king can't move, that's stalemate. If on the board no one can score a victory because your pieces are exhausted or whatever it happens to be, you can tell I'm not a chess player. Don't use the word, this is what he's saying, don't use the word stalemate, because what we can do on our side is introduce two more kings, three more queens. We can repair the castle. We can feed the knight. We can politically motivate the pawn. And all of that's true. No one seriously thinks that what is being played out in Ukraine is a civilized game of chess where the rules are very simple and all pieces, have to obey, or at least the players have to obey the rules very strictly. You cannot suddenly decide to move your king from one end of the chessboard to the other. You can't have your pawns, moving like a bishop or knight. That's all true. And so therefore what we have with our FT, Harvard, no, it's Yale, excuse me, Yale writer, is look at the new technology that Ukraine is being given. I mean, we've just had, he boasts the brilliant success of the, well, we don't know whether it's British or we don't know whether it's French, but the Storm Shadow missiles, which apparently did it for some leading Navy personnel, Russian Navy personnel in Sevastopol. Undoubtedly, that's true. And the United States is either has just supplied, and maybe they're coming on to the battlefield now. Let me get it right. I think I wrote it down what they stand for, but the ATACMSs. Did I write it down? Oh, here we are. Yes. Army Tactical Missile Systems. And these are longer range missiles, I presume, with a great deal of accuracy. All of these things will be, from a Russian point of view, more than a nuisance. But that's not going to change the nature of the war. What the nature of this war is that both sides will be equipping themselves with various bits of technology, all of which have a certain importance. But at the end of the day, what's going to matter is, can your country keep fighting this war? Are you prepared to make the human sacrifice? Well, we know that the United States and NATO is quite prepared to keep supplying Ukraine. Well, I say, maybe not given the US Congress, but from Joe Biden's point of view, he's prepared for Ukraine to sacrifice its young men in the fight to bring down the Putin regime. Of that, I have no doubt. So, yes, Ukraine can play the role of US proxy against the Russian Federation. Can Russia sustain this war? I would argue, at least at the moment and for the foreseeable future, it can. Can it score a decisive victory? That I'm much more skeptical about. If we look at what happened last year, it's true Russia withdrew, but note what it withdrew to. It re with withdrew not because it was facing, wipeout by the brave Ukrainian forces, but because the high command basically said, we're going to defend what we've got. And that might have meant accusations of cowardice and all the rest of it that came from the Wagner Group. But look at it in practice. What has Russia lost in terms of this spring summer offensive? Basically, nothing. Who's lost as a result of this summer offensive is Ukraine. The equipment is replaceable. Germany, France, Britain, the United States can. And I think we'll continue to replace that equipment. But is it going to replace the personnel? Is it going to replace the soldiers on the ground? I think at least that's questionable. I'm not going to push my luck. and any further on that one. And that's the end.